proceed with the next case, which is John Hill versus, well, the defendant's Baxter Healthcare, but we're well beyond that. And let's see, is Mr. Stapleton?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
My name is Mike Stapleton. I'm an attorney from Lafayette, Indiana. My client is Neil Lewis, also an Indiana attorney, who is a non-party in the case below, who is appealing some orders and injunctions that were binding upon him and also an Indiana state court that were entered by the district court after the complete dismissal of a lawsuit. And the focal question of this appeal is, what jurisdiction, if any, did the district court have to entertain motions, petitions, after a complete dismissal of a lawsuit? First question is, did the district court retain any jurisdiction in the dismissal order? The underlying case was a personal injury product liability case, and it was a simple garden variety order of dismissal. The case was dismissed with prejudice. After that...
That was after settlement and everything.
That was after settlement. Mm-hmm. After the settlement. And there was no express retention of jurisdiction in the order. There's not even a hint. You can't... I mean, no matter how you read that order, there's nothing to suggest that the underlying court intended to retain any jurisdiction. And unless the court specifically does, it has no jurisdiction. Unless perhaps we can find another basis for jurisdiction. Perhaps under 28 U.S. Code 1367, whether the court can acquire supplemental jurisdiction. And that doesn't work either. Doesn't work for a couple of reasons. First of all, the original action was brought under 1332 based upon diversity of citizenship. Mr. Hill, the plaintiff in the case, is an Indiana resident. And this additional motion or application a petition was filed against Mr. Lewis, who's also an Indiana resident, so the it would destroy diversity jurisdiction. And 1367 does not allow the court to acquire supplemental jurisdiction if the claim would destroy diversity. Also, parenthetically, the claim that was filed to adjudicate an attorney fee lien or to quash, it was a state law question, is not something that was so intertwined with the original case that it would be the proper subject for supplemental jurisdiction anyhow.
Now, as I understand it, after the pending, once the case was taken over by Fitzpatrick and then filed over here.
Yes.
And then ultimately settlement, during that point in time, Lewis filed
right.
this lien in Indiana.
Right.
Is that right? And I assume it's a dispute over, obviously, attorney's fees and how much he contributed to eventually arriving at this settlement. And now we, if there's whatever is left, if this lien action is to proceed, it's Lewis versus Fitzpatrick and I guess
Hill.
Somebody else maybe. There's money paid into court, and there's money already distributed. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And that was one of the many orders that was entered by the federal court after the settlement, for which we're suggesting the court had no jurisdiction to do. The Hills, in their filings, contend that the district court acquired jurisdiction under Rule 59E, suggesting that their petition to adjudicate a lien, which was a subject of an Indiana lawsuit, is a substantive motion that was sufficient enough to come under Rule 59E. But that doesn't work because, as this court has already said, first of all, we had just a simple order of dismissal, and Rule 59 motions are for reconsideration of matters properly encompassed in a decision on the merits. The dismissal order is not a decision on the merits. It's just a dismissal. There's nothing meritorious. There's nothing for the court to amend or modify. And so Rule 59E does not work. Also, this court has previously held that post-judgment motions regarding attorney fees are not proper Rule 59E material. And that's what this is all about, Judge. It's all about attorney fees that were earned or not earned in the pursuit of this personal injury case.
So your whole argument here, the argument really is centers on timing. What if prior to the approval of the settlement, the matter of this lien would have been called to the attention of the district court? The district court then exercise supplemental jurisdiction?
I think they have a much better case. But the fact is that is not what happened. The court entered a dismissal with prejudice. Had this matter been brought to the court's attention, had the settlement, had the court retained jurisdiction, and had the court grabbed a hold of the settlement proceeds as part of the dismissal order, I think we may not be standing here. But that's not what took place.
Well, in that case, I assume there have been maybe the intervention.
I'm sorry?
There might have been an intervention.
Absolutely.
And then there would have been, the court would have gotten into the whatever contribution and all that sort of thing.
Right. Had there been an attempt to do that, of course my client would have tried to intervene as an indispensable party if the court was going to try to adjudicate his lien. And the question, but there's already a pending.
Well, this was always an elephant in the back of the room, though, wasn't it? That there's a lien from a prior attorney for work done on the case?
You know, that's true. And that's not our. The mistake occurred by the Hills. If that was a concern for them, they should have had the settlement couched in such terms so the court retained jurisdiction. But that's not what took place. My client had a lawsuit pending in Indiana 8 months. 8 months prior to the dismissal of this case, and yet the matter of retention of jurisdiction was never brought to the district court's attention.
Is a copy of that complaint in the record?
Yes.
And it asserts, I assume, breach of contract claims,
right,
against the Hills and tortious interference with contract against Mr. Fitzgerald.
That's correct.
What the district court did here does not purport to adjudicate the merits of those claims.
Well, you know, it does in a way. What it does is it adjudicated the attorney fee lien, and also right now there's still pending motions before the district court that we're responding in a brief today and arguing in a couple of weeks that are trying to control the discovery that's ongoing in the Indiana court. The court is essentially trying to quash my client's lien and adjudicate that it has no merit. That's what's pending in Indiana.
No substantive merit, not that procedurally.
Substantive merit. Is substantively he has no right, no claim to attorney fees.
Does the Anti-Injunction Act have any applicability here?
Yes, it does. And, you know, if you're in the record here, there is some dialogue with the court and the attorneys, and Judge Pallmeyer really was uncertain of her jurisdictional basis. It was clear that she did not do much of an analysis about jurisdiction. Her basis for jurisdiction, she claims, is under the All Writs Act.
You need independent jurisdiction.
Exactly. You need independent jurisdiction. And that's the threshold question. Did the court have jurisdiction at all to do anything before it applied the All Writs Act? And clearly it did not. But if the court is also going to try to mess with what's going on in Indiana, it runs in the face of the anti-injunction statute. So, you know, usually we can always, when we're preparing for this appeal, you might not agree with the other side, but at least you see where they're coming from. We can't see where the other side is coming from in this case. Any basis for jurisdiction at all. Dismissal with prejudice, no retention of jurisdiction, and none of the bases for acquiring supplemental or ancillary jurisdiction are present in this case.
If we were to affirm what was done here, can the Indiana State Court action proceed against the Hills and Mr. Fitzgerald? Or is that an open question?
That's an open question. The motion that the judge is considering right now is to pull the rug out from underneath us on any discovery. There is an Indiana Supreme Court decision on how you resolve these kind of disputes. You look at the relative merits, the contributions to both to all the attorneys in the case in dividing a contingent fee, and the motions that are pending before the court are to prohibit us from getting any information as to what the ultimate outcome was in the personal injury case, which would preclude us from evaluating what my client is entitled to. So the answer to your question is if this court affirms the district court here, we're in a difficult situation.
The state court has just pended the case?
Yes. No, he has not pended the case. The case is we have agreed orally that we would stay our what's going on right now until some decisions are made in the federal court.
Okay.
I think I've used all my time.
Sorry.
Thanks.
Why don't I give you a minute to see how it goes?
Thank you.
You're Mr. Fitzpatrick.
I am.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. Let me address some of the issues the court raised first. The lead of Mr. Lewis, the appellant, was not filed in Indiana. The first time Mr. Lewis surfaced in this case is when he facsimiled lien notices. He didn't send them by certified mail. He didn't hand serve them to anybody. He facsimiled them to predominantly Illinois counsel, and he did so on July 5th, approximately 6 or 7 days after the order of dismissal that was entered here by Judge Pallmeyer on the 29th. Secondarily, there was an issue of whether or not Judge Pallmeyer was proceeding on the idea that she was only endowed with jurisdiction based on the All Writs Act. That's not correct. Essentially, the judge didn't even reach the issue of the All Writs Act until a second motion that we brought to enjoin, which was heard. In fact, that's one of the orders that are at issue here that was heard on August 6th. The court made its ruling relative to the lien issue prior to any issue of All Writs Act being raised. We've never, ever misled the court in that respect. We've never tried to infer here that her only jurisdiction is independently drawn from the All Writs Act. That's just not the case. Her jurisdiction here is based upon supplemental ancillary jurisdiction.
Is there a determination by the district court to that effect in the record?
It would essentially be in probably in the transcript relative to the hearing of the 15th, Your Honor. Because the All Writs Act wasn't an issue at that point. The All Writs Act, essentially the chronology that occurred here is that Mr. Lewis sent these facsimiles. Again, he never filed anything in Indiana with regard to these lien notices. These were all first raised some 31 months after he was terminated. He facsimiled these to Illinois counsel. Upon receipt of those facsimiled, we presented the petition to quash. We presented that after he got notice of that petition to quash. Literally, we FedExed him the notice. He received it the next day. The very same day he goes to Indiana court, and he tries to add the pharmaceutical companies to his action. Because of that, at that point in time, we brought a motion pursuant to the All Writs Act, which was filed, if I recall correctly, on the 26th of July, which was heard on the 6th.
How long after the entry of the dismissal order was that?
I'm sorry?
Your petition to quash, how long after the entry of the judgment?
The petition to quash, I believe we filed on July 8th, if I'm not mistaken. He facsimiled his lien notices on the 5th. We filed our petition to quash on the 8th, and there was no reference to that at all. In fact, we were very clear in the record that we were asking the court to proceed pursuant to her ancillary jurisdiction. Let me.
In ancillary jurisdiction, are you referring to Rule 59?
We were in error, Judge. It is not 59. There is, as counsel indicated, it is not a judgment. This is a Rule 41 order. However, and we pointed this out in the briefs, as Bear points out, where you have an order that was entered, such as the one that she entered on the 29th. She entered a Rule 41 order on the 29th, where you have an order which specifically approves of the settlement, as she did. You have a retention of ancillary jurisdiction, and here's
that implied because it was dismissed.
Correct. In fact, but let's be very clear: the draft order involved here, was a two-part order. The initial order was what counsel was suggesting. In other words, dismissal pursuant to stipulation. If that is all we had here, this would be clearly a Kekkonen situation. There would be no ancillary jurisdiction. But the court didn't stop there. The court proceeded and made a further order in that same draft order. Page 2, she specifically states that she is making a good faith finding relative to the various settlement agreements entered into between the parties. In other words, she's approving of the settlements. That's precisely precisely what was occurring in the Bayer versus first options case, which we cited. Secondarily, and I think this is equally important.
Now, wasn't there an express incorporation of the terms of the settlement agreement in that case, as well as a retention of an attorney's fees dispute?
No, you're talking about Bayer now, is that correct? With respect to Bayer, there was the settlement agreement was privately negotiated, and there was an approval by the court of it. But there was absolutely no replication of the agreement within the terms of the order. The judge approved of the order, but there was no attachment.
But in that case, the judge also directed that the money be paid into the court, and that was a part of the order, which is not the case here.
The money has been paid into the court.
That happened after.
Correct.
So that takes it outside of Bayer. This case outside of Bayer. In Bayer, the order of dismissal called for the payment to be made to the court, so there's obviously a retention of jurisdiction associated with that for purposes of dispersing the money. That's not the case.
I think Bayer was saying that this is further evidence that the court intended.
Right, but that didn't happen before the.
But something equally important happened, Your Honor, and that is this: it wasn't just simply approving of the settlement, but if you continue to read the second page of the draft order, the court was very specific that it was stating that this settlement agreement and this order would act as a bar to any future activity against these very defendants, which is precisely, I might add, precisely what occurred here, and this is why I think that's important. If the court is entering an order, and I would ask the court to focus on the last three sentences of that particular draft order, if the court is basically saying you are barred from proceeding against these defendants, you are by definition you are anticipating prospective future activity.
For contribution or indemnification, that's not what we're talking about here. That's what the language refers to. Settlements operate as a bar to the bringing of any actions for contribution and or indemnification.
That's correct.
That doesn't incorporate anything relative to this fee dispute or constitute any sort of retention of jurisdiction over a fee dispute with a former attorney.
The language of the cases is consistent, Your Honor. The language of the cases are there are no specific magic words. In other words, and we pointed this out in Montgomery. Montgomery just basically says there's two ways that you can preserve ancillary jurisdiction. Either you incorporate, and I think that's what's being bandied about here, either you incorporate the settlement agreement into the order, or you have an express retention of jurisdiction.
That's neither here.
But if I might respectfully disagree, the cases that we pointed out here with respect to McCall Bay, where there was an even more attenuated situation, where you have the order doesn't even refer, the order only refers to the stipulation. The stipulation refers to the settlement agreement, and then there's some language in there with respect to enforcement in the settlement agreement. You had a series of incorporations, and the court said that is sufficient. You don't, in other words, McCall Bay and I think Bayer stand for this proposition, if I'm correct. You don't need a replication of the settlement agreement into the final order. You can do it by reference. That's the implied.
If we accept that, then any dismissal order that approves a private settlement that is contained in a private contract between the parties necessarily involves a retention of jurisdiction. I mean, that's so broad.
But that's not where the court stopped here. I mean, the court was, and I know what Your Honor was saying, it was anticipating with a specific circumstance of indemnity or contribution. But it's anticipating future prospective activity.
That's against the parties.
This whole issue is, I think,
a certain amount of attorney's fees that have been awarded.
Not entirely, Your Honor. In fact,
what else is there?
The fees that are being held in the registry are our fees that we're asking for are one-third, the standard one-third. In addition to that are the monies that are due the Hills, the remaining amounts that are due the Hills. The Hills had a distribution of 53%. It's our contention that the Hills still have approximately some 14% of those
funds. How much money is involved?
I'm sorry?
How much money are we talking about here? What's the settlement?
Unfortunately, Your Honor, that's pursuant to a confidentiality agreement.
All right.
So I'd feel
know that. It's not a record name.
It's not, right. It's under seal.
What if there was an expert witness that had been retained a long ago in Kentucky or something, and now the settlement's gone down, and they say, we haven't been paid. Can they come into the federal district court and invoke supplementary jurisdiction to adjudicate whether they're entitled to any money?
I think the Bayer Court would suggest that they would be, yes.
What about the Anti-Injunction Act?
Thank you, Your Honor. I know you raised that before. The Anti-Injunction Act has three specific delineations, exceptions to it, one of which is the case law talks about with the All Writs Act, where a court is entering order in furtherance of its jurisdiction to avoid its orders being thwarted. And if I can pick up a little bit on that particular point, one of the two orders that is at issue here is the order of August 6th. It's the order that enjoined the appellant from proceeding against these defendants, and that is precisely the type of protection that the court envisioned in its order of the 29th. That's essentially said to protect them against all actions, the pharmaceutical, not the lien, not the monies of the lien, but as far as protecting the pharmaceutical companies. They've bought their piece; they're entitled to that. The order of the 6th is just simply an enforcement of that order of the 29th. And if I might raise one additional issue with the court, we cited this in our brief with respect to the Moore case. And Moore and its progeny stands for a very strong, separate, I think perhaps complementary, but certainly a separate issue of jurisdiction. And that says, when the court has the funds, it has equitable jurisdiction for the disbursement of those funds until all claims against those funds are exhausted. This court exercises jurisdiction, I think appropriately, pursuant to ancillary supplemental jurisdiction. But irrespective of that, this court still has the funds in its possession, and pursuant to Moore and its progeny, has the right to make all the decisions relative to disbursement of those funds.
But if those funds came into court pursuant to an extra-jurisdictional order that is void, then that rule doesn't apply, right? Or aren't you conceding that?
I don't think
these orders were entered without jurisdiction, then the fact that the money's been paid in.
No, because essentially, I mean, the rule in Moore is one that's descended from the Supreme Court decision in Aldinger, which is some 50 or 60 years old. And essentially it says that this kind of equitable jurisdiction is freestanding. It is the purest form of ancillary jurisdiction, quite candidly. It wouldn't matter. The court has the funds. These are funds that were generated not in some abstract sense. These were funds that were generated from this particular lawsuit, and this court has the right to disperse those funds pursuant to any claims that are made against it. And I would suggest that that's what Moore and its progeny stands for. There is that separate equitable jurisdiction.
So regardless of how many jurisdictional mistakes were made here, once the money's in, the court has equitable jurisdiction over it and can issue injunctions against a state court action to its heart's content?
Well, I don't believe it's that.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to trivialize it. But.
Right. No, it's a form of ancillary jurisdiction, but it's a separate line of cases that derives again from the Supreme Court. If the court has the funds, if the court has the race in its possession, as it does here, clearly, it was paid into the court. When the court has those funds, it can make the disbursements. I apologize, I've gone over.
You are running over, that's for sure. What do you need? Wrap it up.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. The only thing I would say to this court is that relative to the Indiana action, as this court recognized, the primary basis is this tortious interference. I have presented a motion to dismiss that case. That motion was denied. We contend very clearly I had no contacts with Indiana. There is no jurisdiction in Indiana. Ultimately, we will pursue that on appeal in Indiana to the effect that there is no jurisdiction there. With regard to the, and I would just ask this court to affirm the two orders of the court below. Thank you very much.
Okay, I'll give you a little more time here, Mr. Stapleton. Make it quick if you can.
I want to comment just briefly about the Bayer decision that seems to be relied heavily upon the appellee in this case. And that was a Title VII case in which fees are part of the overall order. And there was language in the Bear case that is directly in point here. It says that it referred to contingent fee cases. Contingent fee disputes are outside the ancillary jurisdiction, unlike the Title VII case, because it bears no relationship to the underlying litigation. So even though the Bear Court did consider a fee issue in a Title VII case as part of its ancillary jurisdiction, it recognized because Title VII fee issues are part of the our main dispute, it did not apply to contingent fee disputes, which we have here. This is the first time we've heard it wasn't that the court's jurisdiction wasn't under Rule 59. I mean, that's the first suggestion in all the briefing. They've been using Rule 59 and the All Writs Act for some of the activity in this case. The ultimate irony in this whole dispute is we are not trying to invade the federal court's decision. We applaud it. My client wants it. My client needs it. He has no claim until that case is settled. We do not want to do anything to impair that. We do not want to do anything to anything against any of the defendants in that case. All he wants is the opportunity to pursue his state court action in Indiana, which has been pending for 8 months prior to this case was dismissed. And not
who are the parties to that? Who would be the parties to that suit?
Mr. Hill, the plaintiff, Mr. Fitzpatrick, the defense counsel. Also, there's another law firm that Mr. Fitzpatrick is refusing to pay that was part of a written
pharmaceutical companies are they have no business in all.
They have no business in that. They have no business in the Indiana case other than the fact that if they're
see, a lawyer.
Yeah, I know.
I'm going to say they have no business other than the all right, what's the other than
the? Actually the funds have already been taken care of. We don't want to deal with the pharmaceutical companies. All we want to deal with is the proceeds of the settlement, of which the district court had no jurisdiction doing anything with at all because it had no jurisdiction.
I mean, after the settlement.
After the settlement, sure.
After the dismissal.
Yeah. This would set a dangerous precedent if the court should decide that they retained ancillary supplemental jurisdiction based upon that dismissal, because there's no hint of retention of jurisdiction in that order.
Okay, thanks. The case will be taken under advisement.